Investable Universe is about thematic topics in real assets investing. This is what we mean by the global market of things: real estate, infrastructure, land, energy, and other commodities that have historically been viewed as boring old income investments. But take a look at the shifts underway in these asset classes, from industry disruptors to new investors to emerging markets to geopolitics, and you'll find these assets are very interesting. We'll talk about private equity, venture capital, corporate VC, sovereign wealth funds, listed markets, crazy startups, some old guard investment firms, some maverick entrepreneurs, and some paradigm-shifting technologies. One thing is certain, no corner of the global market of things will be left untouched by the changes happening right now, and that's what we talk about on this podcast. Okay, so in this episode, we're going to take a look at transformational changes underway in the space transportation industry. It's hard to believe it's already possible to disrupt space transportation when the industry itself is barely off the ground, but it's true. And the company at the forefront of this, Phantom Space, believes that by taking a twist on the assembly line approach to car manufacturing that led to a rapid scaling of the global automobile industry, something similar can be done for satellite launches. The founder and CEO of Phantom Space, Jim Cantrell, speaks on good authority in this regard. Cantrell is a mechanical engineer, entrepreneur, and space visionary who began his career in the late 1980s as a developer of Mars transportation technologies. He previously worked for the French Space Agency, CNES, and the Space Dynamics Laboratory for the U.S. Department of Defense. In 2001, he was the first vice president of business development at SpaceX, working alongside Elon Musk, leaving the startup in 2002 to found Strategic Space Development and ultimately Phantom Space. He also served on source selection panels for NASA for 15 years, reviewing proposals for deep space and space science missions. Phantom Space is a privately held company that recently received seed round venture funding. Jim Cantrell, thank you for speaking with Investable Universe today.
My pleasure.
So let's start. Maybe you can break down the state of space transportation for our listeners here, because I thought that this was the cutting edge, but it would seem that perhaps it's not. Space ride sharing is not the end of the industry.
Well, yeah, so space transportation is really where the automotive industry was about 120 years ago. The Model T was really the first of a generation of cars that were mass-produced that became cheap. They were something on the order of $800 and then your dollars, whereas, you know, most cars are selling for $8,000-$9,000, which if you fast-forward that inflation today, that's every bit as expensive as the Lamborghinis and Ferraris you might buy today. So space is really kind of in that frothy early stage. And because space transportation is so much more capital-intensive and it's energetically intensive, it tends to go a little bit slower. It was also government-dominated in its early years rather than entrepreneurial-dominated. That also slowed it down. And instead of coming from horse-drawn buggies, our rockets really came from ICBMs. And they were weapons of war that got turned into satellite launchers. And so what we're seeing is really a lot of the same themes playing out in the space transportation industry that we saw in the automotive industry. So where space transportation is also today is, just like the sort of the common person having a car, satellites have gotten smaller and more affordable. So that's essentially the equivalent of, say your mom and dad having a car back in those days. Right. And whereas, you know, the main players in satellites have been, you know, satellite operators that built billion-dollar kinds of satellites that weigh thousands of pounds. Mm-hmm. So this disruption in the market demand created a demand for rideshare, which came along really as a government invention on a way to get some of these payloads into space, and has become a commercial economy now that is riding on the tails of the rather large reusable rockets that SpaceX is building. In the early days before SpaceX came around, the old Russian converted ICBMs were carrying much of the freight to space, but SpaceX has come on, kind of cornered the market on mass to orbit for these smaller satellites. So there's really an evolving set of competing economic systems in space transportation, where you have large reusable rockets like SpaceX has mastered. Then you have the small mass manufactured rockets, which Phantom is trying to master. Okay. So we see the future having one, two, or three of these kinds of economic systems as we go forward. And they'll probably all survive and bifurcate the market because, you know, some systems serve parts of the market better than others, more economically than others. And it will naturally sort of divide itself out.
So as you mentioned just then, Phantom Space is going all in with small rocket launches rather than the rideshare market for satellites. Why is that?
Well, so the reason why we're doing it, first of all, is that it's something nobody's doing. We don't think anybody is rightfully trying to mass produce. We're talking hundreds of year, maybe 1,000 a year down the road. Nobody's trying to do that. There's a lot of people in the small rocket business, and I submit that it's because the capital requirements for small rockets is much lower than it is for big rockets. But the downside of rideshare is that you can't go where you want when you want. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like taking a ride to Chicago with your uncle when you really want to go to New York, and he wants to leave on Monday, and you really don't want to leave till the week after. Mm-hmm. But you got to go because that's the only way to get there, and then you got to hitch a ride on, or just enjoy Chicago instead of New York, which is in satellite terms, that's really what you end up doing. Mm-hmm. So you know, it also costs, as you as a satellite operator, it also costs you more. That time delay, you may be delayed up to 3 years mm-hmm. in some cases. That's not unusual. Also, going to the wrong place can cost you revenue. And then you also have to engineer your satellite specifically for this. You can imagine 50 to 100 satellites glued onto this backbone structure on a rocket. There's some engineering that goes into that. That's millions of dollars. So mm-hmm. we believe we can cut their net cost of access to orbit by half. Wow. And we think that's going to be attractive, the price alone, but you can also, if we're doing enough of these, you can pick the time when you want to go, mm-hmm. and you can also go where you want because we're launching you there. Furthermore, the future of these satellites is largely constellations. If you look out of the next 35,000 satellites over the next 10 years that are projected to go up, a good majority of them are constellations. Mm-hmm. So the constellations replenishment, which is going to be a thing, you can't do with launch vehicles. You simply can't, because you're going to have these satellites in a bunch of different orbits, and you're not going to want to launch, say, 50 of them in that one orbit to replace two or three. Mm-hmm. And so we think that the small launch can pick parts of the market that are actually the growing segments. I submit that the small launch market is going to be the dominant market 10, 15 years down the road.
Wow. So if you could project a dollar value to the small launch market, what would it be?
Today, the launch market is about $20 billion a year, something on that order. The addressable market for small right now is about $6 or $7 mm-hmm. billion on the high side, depending on where you cut the line on small. Mm-hmm. And what I see is that growing from $6 or $7 to about $20 billion, if we believe the numbers that are going up over the next 10 years. So it'll easily be 50% of the market within 10, 15 years.
Can you talk about the space supply chain that you rely on for parts?
Yeah, the reality is anybody builds anything, whether it's an automobile, a SpaceX rocket, or a Phantom rocket, mm-hmm. is going to be relying on some level of supply chain somewhere. The question is, where is that cut line? And at Phantom, we chose that cut line much higher than, say, SpaceX, who controls all the systems. And with respect to their engines, for example, when I was there, that was one of the first things we did was started on the engines. I was on the turbopump program there, mm-hmm. running that for the time I was there. And we went to a third-party supplier who'd done the work for NASA. Eventually, SpaceX brought that in. They brought the whole engine in. We knew at that time, because if we wanted to undercut the existing cost of launch, we had to get outside of the what I call the military industrial complex and their inherent cost structure. And we could only do that by building our own. Same was also true of things like avionics and so forth. Mm-hmm. You go forward today, and even back then we were, you still have to buy some parts. You buy the materials. You can't mine the shit out of the ground and, mm-hmm. and produce your own aluminum, even though Elon wanted to do that at one point. you're still buying processors, you're buying electronic parts and so forth. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to Phantom some 20 years later, what we found was because of this growth in entrepreneurial space, there's been a lot of capital invested in really what amounts to a new supply chain. You've got engines, for example, we're buying our engines from a company called Ursa Major in Colorado that's already put $50 million into building engines. We don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. And so we're buying from them. The avionics we licensed from NASA, they had it on a program that they never got to fly, and the software is all available. So, you know, but that's relying on a $50 processor board that we could buy on Amazon. So it does put us in a little more vulnerable of a position, but what you have to do as a business is you have to strategize about how you mitigate those risks. Mm-hmm. Everywhere you turn, there's going to be some risk. Supply chain risk is going to be there no matter what. Right now, I understand that Detroit is unable to produce as many cars as there is demand because there's a chip shortage.
Right.
And, is Detroit going to get into building chips? No, I don't think so. You know, even weapon systems have this problem. Mm-hmm. I remember the shuttle towards the end of its life. There were certain processors that were no longer produced that they had a secret program where people were actually going out on eBay buying old electronics that had some of these parts in them that were supply for the shuttle.
Are you permitted to use foreign suppliers? Because I imagine space and aerospace and anything that's, you know, weapons correlated, I mean, there are going to be some higher barriers to access, let's say.
So legally speaking, yes. Mm-hmm. Practically speaking, we try to avoid it. Mm-hmm. So what is happening in the Defense Department, the U.S. Defense Department, is a secure supply chain initiative is been coming online for several years now. Mm-hmm. And I've worked closely with the Defense Department on some other programs prior to Phantom, where I became aware of this. And the issue is not only parts that are, shall we say, counterfeit, but also there are some parts that are considered to be deliberately sabotaged. Mm-hmm. So there's a concern on the part of the Defense Department that there's both a quality and a security issue behind some foreign source parts. And so what we at Phantom are striving to do is to minimize the origin of those. And if we do have foreign source parts, that they're clearly not tied to what we're doing, so they can't be deliberately sabotaged. So we like to think of ourselves as the only U.S. Supply chain rocket out there. There's a number of others who've opted for reasons of their own to, mm-hmm. to buy engines from Ukraine, for example, mm-hmm. To accept money from foreign countries that might have less than positive relationships with the U.S. Mm-hmm. So, we're not doing it necessarily out of patriotism, but mm-hmm. we think it makes sound business strategy to make sure that our big potential customer, the U.S. Defense Department and NASA, both of them are very happy with our supply chain strategy.
Sure. And is that sort of a proprietary approach by Phantom Space, or are there other aerospace suppliers that go to those sort of beyond the norm lengths to ensure the integrity of the supply chain?
I spent some time researching, how serious the Pentagon was about this for mm-hmm. another company I helped start years ago. It's a foreign company, supplies satellites. And what I found out was that the Defense Department is absolutely serious about this.
Yeah.
And while it's not 100% implemented yet, that it's clearly going to be over time. So I think as this evolves, you're going to see others following suit. You see right now, for example, Momentus was not allowed to have FAA approval to launch twice. And they became very open in saying that the FAA disallowed this because of foreign involvement in their financing and foreign mm-hmm. control of the company. Mm-hmm. So, we've got other companies that have built rockets, which are considered by our government to be weapon systems, for better or for worse. I think it's, a funny thing to call my satellite launcher a weapon system, but I surely can see why you could use it or how you could use it that way. Yeah. But it's still considered a very sensitive technology. And U.S. is, trying its best to prevent the proliferation of it all over the world. So that's the motivation behind it. I don't think it's going away.
Uh-huh. So we talked a little about how supply chains have been disrupted or affected by the pandemic. How did the pandemic affect space R&D or deal making, for that matter?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We started this in October of 2019, just before the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. And our going in position with Phantom, one of the reasons we did the supply chain approach we did was that the air had come out of the bubble of the investment and launch. Mm-hmm. And our assumption was that deal making and capital investment was going to be scarcer as going forward. We were right in that, but we weren't aware of why that was going to be. Mm-hmm. So we set ourselves up to operate very lean in the beginning days. And when COVID came out, we did find that the deal making hit a brick wall for about 3 months. We had started, you know, with some personal money between the co-founders. We put a pretty substantial amount of our own personal money in to get started. So we were able to make it through that period. And then the deal making actually picked up pretty quick. But sort of perversely, what happened to us was, there, you know, you've heard these stories about 100 small rocket startups out there that were funded at various levels. A good majority of them went away from the results of the pandemic. There was a lot of shutdown by the VCs of existing, in fact, very successful startups. For example, ISI, one of them, I know they shut down for a couple months because the VCs weren't completely understanding where the market was going to go. So there was a huge amount of uncertainty as the pandemic unveiled itself in early 2020. And as a result of that, there was a lot of, I would call it, weaker financed companies that went away. So it cleared most of our competition out, which was a very unintended consequence. We were one of the last ones standing in the rocket business. There were a few more, but, you know, we were one of the few, and we were probably the youngest, which was a real surprise. And, you know, it gave us pause, I will admit. During the COVID thing, I thought, boy, did I pick a wrong time to start a rocket company. And, you know, it turned out to be good. Now, as far as like the R&D, nobody seemed to have missed a beat. You know, we went to working from home, most companies. And, you know, frankly, I think this is actually a move in the right direction. So being able to operate from home, with the exception of a few things, is much more efficient. And, you know, I think it's something that's here to stay. You know, we raised our two rounds, subsequent rounds, without having to get on a single airplane. You know, we're raising a much bigger round right now, and there's a little bit of airplane flying, but it's not nearly like what it used to be. So, you know, people still need to get returns on their money, and stuff still needs to be built. We just found a way around it.
So what exactly is involved in mass manufacturing small rocket launch vehicles? I mean, it's not just the most straightforward thing.
Well, it is and it isn't. So it turns out, and this will sound strange, but the rocket's the easy part. It's the launch and the flight operations that are the tough part that you've got to really master. So in terms of the rocket itself, you know, it's on par with a car in terms of its complexity, number of parts and so on. So a moving assembly line kind of operation is what we're envisioning for, you know, building these things, let's say 1,000 a year is our goal. That's three a day. That's a that's a slow moving assembly line. And, you know, the techniques for that are well known. There's, you know, probably some robotics involved, but it resembles largely, say, what Ferrari does, something on that order, which is not a you know, not a huge River Rouge factory like Ford has or something like that. The real challenge, and this is where I think we differ from everybody else, is how you actually launch these at that rate. It's one thing to say you're going to, it's another thing to do it. Recognize that we have four licensed launch sites in the United States. There's probably something on the order of seven that I count internationally recognized launch sites around the world. On top of that, if you look at how many launches go out of each site, maybe 20 a year on a busy site. So if you take all, you know, 13 of them, that means you've got 130 a year or something like that. And I think the worldwide launches last year were 70, 80, something like that. So we're talking about, you know, increasing the number of launches by almost an order of magnitude per year. So that's a major hit on launch infrastructure. So you have to do two things. First, you have to have a minimal footprint on the launch infrastructure so you're not closing down the entire operation. So that implies, you know, how are you going to operate? Where are you going to operate? And on what tempo are you going to operate? So we see, you know, right now we've leased a site at Vandenberg that's going to be our own. So we can, you know, launch out of there, range permitting, at the highest rate that we possibly can, that the range is consistently able to do. We're working on one at Cape Canaveral. We have a site lease at Alaska. And then eventually we're going to do Camden and probably Virginia. But then beyond that, what we have to think about is how do we start to launch from these landlocked sites. So there are spaceports in the United States, for example, in Midland, Texas, where they're licensed for horizontal launch, which means on an aircraft, but you can't fire a rocket off over inland because mainly the debris that drops down on people creates a hazard. Yet in these same places, we have large 747 jets that take off daily, fly over millions of people loaded with four and five times more fuel than we have. So in terms of flight safety, there exists the possibility that you can eventually fly out of these landlocked sites. But we believe that the technology that's required to do that is number one, being able to retrieve reliably the first stage. There's a lot of reasons why you want to do that. So we're putting all this together. We have a series of vehicles that we have planned. The first one, the Daytona, simple, expendable. Let's get up. Let's get something working. We're going to evolve into a retrievable first stage, again, aimed at launching eventually from some of these landlocked sites. Plus, we don't want to be dropping hundreds of boosters in the ocean from both ecological and national security standpoints. And we just think it makes more sense to retrieve it if we can. So we're going to bake in, you know, the loss, essentially, that extra fuel that you have to put up and use to bring back the stage. And we think it just makes an overall better system. So that's really, you know, as far as advanced manufacturing goes, that's that in a nutshell.
So who's your typical client and what is the size of the check they will be writing to Phantom Space in order to get something launched?
I would say our most common client is a mature startup that's in the launch phase of their company, and typically they'll have been in business 4 or 5 years. They'll be putting up a constellation, and we'll be putting up some or all of the constellation. Mm-hmm. They may or may not have had us build the satellite for them. We've already built one satellite since we've been in business, and you know, we've got two more contracts on the way. That are actually under contract, but the hardware will be on its way. So we may have had a broader involvement than launch, or it may be a NASA or a DoD contractor that is launching NASA DoD payloads or NASA DoD itself. So check sizes, you know, typically for a launch for us is like $4 million for a Daytona. For our bigger ones, it's the Laguna, as we call it, it's going to be about $6 or $7 million. Mm-hmm. So fairly small checks for launch. You know, I'm used to seeing $100 to $500 million for launch. So we're, mm-hmm. you know, we're way down there, kind of like Henry Ford and the Model T.
Sure. And so when you typically work with a client, you know, when they write that $4 or $5 million check, is that the end of your involvement with them?
Yeah, we see ourselves as partners with them for life, really, servicing their needs in terms of launch and space assets and so forth. You know, we offer a full line of spacecraft components, including propulsion systems and telemetry systems. We have a number of these components that we're building. One client, for example, is contemplating that we have under contract is looking at 24 satellites. We're probably going to build the first one for them and launch it. And then assuming we do a good job and everything works, then it will naturally launch the rest of them. So this business is really about finding people with whom you can trust and trust to get the job done right. And we seek to establish that trust with our clients that they want to come back to us. And eventually our Phantom Cloud will service their data needs, because what that is intended to do is to provide, in essence, a mesh network in space that the satellites can communicate to, and we can take care of the space to ground part of it. So really all they need is an idea and the money and a computer to gather their data back from. Ultimately, that's how we want to turn this business into, where we take care of the sort of the spooky, how do you launch and build satellites part of it, and they let them concentrate on what they're good at, which is their business app.
Yeah. Now, so we mentioned Henry Ford and his innovations in terms of the automobile assembly line, and how really paying factory line workers $5 to work on the assembly line created a new class of consumers who could afford the Model T, right? So do you see this kind of democratization of the space market as also part of your vision for Phantom Space, and that people who maybe work on Phantom Space will become people who want to launch something?
Well, absolutely. It's actually our customers that we're enabling. And the more successful they are with smaller checks, then the more they'll be able to raise bigger checks and do bigger ideas. You know, most of the people we run into have enormous visions for what they want to do with their space company. Mm-hmm. And it's always amazing to me to hear these different ideas that people have and their appetite for doing them. It's almost limitless, the things I'm hearing, and the creativity is impressive. So what we really get excited about is bringing the larger creativity of society into this sector and having that creativity applied to the sector, because for us, it's like looking at the new world in the 1500s, that it's this frontier economy that we really don't know what we're going to do with yet. So we really need to apply the best and brightest minds. And they're not always attracted to space to this point. You know, it was admittedly a very boring, stodgy, government-dominated industry for many years, that guys with pocket protectors and funny glasses with pieces of tape between the eyes would dominate. And now it's becoming cool. And now it's becoming something that is not just, you know, Americans can do, but countries around the world can do. I mean, countries can have their own space programs now for very small dollars, you know, if they're relying on commercial capabilities. We're also, and you know, the Department of Defense guys agree to this finally, but we're also helping solve the problems of like the Department of Defense. They can no longer afford to develop a lot of these capabilities themselves because the deficits are high, budgets are tight, and it's more important for them to be mission focused and not technology focused. And we can provide the technologies. It's like the government trying to build their own iPhones. Nobody would laugh at that. You know, we really want to. Our vision is to displace all of that so that people can think about missions and more people can come in. And that's what really, I think, excites us all in terms of democratization.
So as we mentioned in the intro, you are a co-founder of SpaceX back in the day. Maybe you could walk us back through your space bio, your history with Moon Express, and how that all contributed to the origin story of Phantom Space and just your worldview as a space visionary. I mean, as we said, this is, you know, as you just said, this is an area that was long considered very stodgy, very government dominated, and now it's suddenly become exciting.
Yeah, so I never really wanted to get into the space business, believe it or not. I wanted to go into the automotive industry. That was kind of my first love, and got diverted off because I took a NASA-sponsored design course in college, which was meant to do what it did with me, which was to get more engineering talent involved in the space industry. And they were post-Apollo, seeing a big brain drain. So I did that, got a internship with the Jet Propulsion Lab, where they'd flown all these things to Mars and Mercury and, you know, Voyager and all these great things. You know, I never thought I'd ever be considered part of that world. And part of that experience was I met these folks from French Space Agency, also then the Soviet Space Agency. This was, you know, pre-Putin in Russia, so in the late 80s. And so I, through cooperation with them, informal, I ended up getting a job with a French space agency over in Toulouse, building a Mars balloon on a Soviet mission to Mars. And, you know, in the late 80s, I didn't realize, I guess that was the wrong thing to do. I just did it. And it wasn't illegal, of course, but some people considered it amoral, I guess, to work with the Soviets. I was just always curious about them and found that to be a very enriching experience. Learned French. I also learned Russian when I was there. I took Russian lessons in French. Was kind of weird, but when the Soviet Union fell apart in 91, I could see it was coming apart. So I headed back to the United States by 92, and I couldn't find a job. So I went back to the university where I come from. Part of the reason I couldn't find a job is people considered me a bit of a traitor, having worked with the Soviets and the French. And I was even voting for Ronald Reagan back then, so I thought it funny I was considered a traitor. But it was a strange time, I tell you. And it was very quick that I was recruited to go back to the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and help the U.S. government, the intelligence agencies in particular, to help stop brain drain. Mm-hmm. One of the things we knew from the projects that we were working on with the French was that the Soviets ceased to get paid once the putsch happened. You know, it was a system where if anybody made money in the country, they got paid by the government because it was communism. Mm-hmm. And the system fell apart. Nobody was getting paid any longer. And so good, you know, men were looking for ways to feed their families. And so they would take jobs with the Iranians, the North Koreans, and so on. So my job was to go put money into the system by hook or crook. And, you know, we had lists of people we were targeting. Mm-hmm. And so I spent about 6 years doing that. Part of what we ended up doing was helping convert ICBMs to satellite launchers. That was sort of my first introduction to launch vehicles, even though I studied it in college. Yeah. And also we built satellites. We did some missile defense cooperative research with them, and all sorts of very interesting things. By about 98, I was done with that. You know, we had launched two satellites out of a submarine, one out of Kazakhstan. Had some great experiences doing all that. And then by about 2001, this guy Elon Musk calls me out of the blue. And it was not unusual at the time to have these so-called internet millionaires interested in space. That was kind of vogue back then, 20-some-plus years ago. You know, and I had taken a number of people, including the Gross Brothers, who was Idea Lab, was one of their big things they did, over to Russia to see if there was things you could do, because Russia was able to do things in space very cheaply, and that was attracting the internet money, you know, to do things which didn't cost hundreds of millions of dollars, right? So you could early on see the attraction of capital investment to that kind of environment. And so Elon, you know, called in July of 2001, wanted to do a private mission to Mars. He'd just been let go from PayPal. And so he wanted to, you know, buy Russian rockets, and he'd heard that I knew the guys. And so, yeah, so I consulted with him for about the next 9 months there, 9, 10, 12 months, something like that. And we went over to Russia a few times, tried to buy rockets. We ended up designing a Martian mission, which was going to grow a plant on the surface of Mars. He was always interested in this idea of terraforming Mars and showing that humanity could become multiplanetary and so on. Mm-hmm. So this was, you know, his original idea. It was called Mars Oasis. And so when we went to buy the rockets for it, the Russians wouldn't deal with him.
Why?
And, well, he was young. He was in the late 20s. He didn't dress according to the Russian standards very well. You know, by today's standards, he dressed pretty well. But, you know, he wouldn't wear a suit, wouldn't wear a tie. And, you know, I kind of understood the system and knew it was a very ageist kind of community. And you had to, you know, if you weren't the oldest, you know, you weren't going to be the leadership. So they didn't understand the concept of somebody in their 20s that dressed like crap, that didn't speak particularly well and interrupted them, would actually have enough money to actually buy these rockets. So they didn't take them seriously. And what's ironic in history is they slit their own throats because it gave him enough motivation to go back and start SpaceX. And that's exactly what he did. So part of the group of people I brought together to do this Mars mission, they were building rockets in their garage in their spare time. And Elon on his weekends came across these rockets that they were building and got very interested. And as a result, they started thinking about, you know, what would a rocket look like if we were to build it ourselves? And so that was kind of the famous trip back from Moscow with Mike Griffin and me, where Elon announced that he had a spreadsheet with this rocket, and we looked at it and decided it was actually pretty real. That was the Falcon 1. Mm-hmm. So I joined up with those guys, despite you know, Elon's proclamation in the latest book that I was only consulting. He actually hired me as a vice president of business development. And to the question of foundership, in the early days he used to introduce me as a co-founder, but then he got mad at me later and told me I wasn't a co-founder. So I just leave the subject alone. So all I know is I was vice president of business development until I left in September of that year. And I left because I couldn't fathom this succeeding. And I've learned a lot since then. I was obviously very wrong. But I also didn't see the shuttle retiring either, which is really, I think, one of the key events that allowed the U.S. government to put a little over $1 billion into SpaceX that mm-hmm. was money well spent by the government, but really made their Falcon 9 viable. And then, you know, once that happened, then the investment money piled in and the rest is history. So I went off, started Stratospace, and figured I could make, you know, my millions on consulting, which I did. I did very well. That evolved into a spacecraft system engineering and a spacecraft building kind of activity. I was involved in Iridium. I was involved in OSIRIS-REx, which retrieved some samples off the asteroid. LightSail 1 and 2 with the Planetary Society. That was my brainchild, helped build that. Then that really led to, you know, being involved in satellites, realizing the problem with launch and trying to solve this problem. So started a company called Vector. That went pretty well until it didn't, and I left there in August of 2019. And Phantom was really a follow-on to try and continue that mission that Vector started of mass-produced small launch vehicles. So here we are.
So just quickly, can you talk about your core vehicles, the Laguna and the Daytona rockets, and just like what is the use case for each of them? Why would I choose one and not the other?
So the Daytona is the first. So if you were wanting to buy something in the near term, that's the only one you can buy.
Okay.
So it's about 450 kilograms to orbit, 1,000 pounds roughly. It's relatively small. It's using seven Hadley engines from Ursa Major on the first stage and one modified Hadley on the second. And all made out of aluminum, nothing fancy, a little bit of carbon fiber here and there, but pretty much a traditional rocket, but small, and designed to be mass-produced, you know, with robotic welding and things of that nature. It's really designed to be a workhorse for the small satellite community. And we designed it to launch two what's known as ESPA secondary satellites. So the ESPA ring is classically what you see flying on, that secondary is flying on. It's a sort of wedding looking thing that goes underneath a bigger satellite. And all of the satellites, the secondary satellites, hang on like diamonds on a wedding ring and get deployed in space. So what we designed this for is to take two of those and launch these into space, or one slightly heavier version, as being sort of the optimal market need. And we did a lot of analysis and research on this to come up with the sizing, and that's what we ended up with, is a highly profitable size. The Laguna is a bit bigger than this, and the reason it's a bit bigger is it will also be expendable, but it's a pathfinder for the reusable R, the Daytona reusable version. And so the Laguna eventually becomes the reusable Daytona. We need the extra capacity, but it also can launch a bigger class of satellites. So you essentially extend your market reach by having this other vehicle in the inventory that can launch even bigger stuff. We believe that that market's fairly small, that additional, you know, reach that you can get on the market, but it is justifiable in, you know, sort of the technology development plan that we have. So eventually, you know, we'll produce only the Laguna, but it will be, one will be called the Daytona, which is reusable, and the other Laguna, which is not. And so if you were to fly Laguna, it's because you have a, you know, 1,000 kilogram or 2,000 1-ton size satellite, which is getting pretty big, or you want to do a reusable, retrievable first stage on the Daytona, as we discussed earlier.
So you mentioned that Phantom Space has been out raising a new round of capital. Can you talk about who your investors are? And are you permitted to pursue foreign partnerships, international partnerships? I can imagine you might run into some CFIUS issues. Oh, always an issue. Yeah.
Yeah, CFIUS, the Committee for Foreign Investment in the U.S., has become a big part of our vocabulary.
Yeah.
Yes, we're allowed to have CFIUS investments. We have sort of fencing that gets put around it by our State Department and Department of Commerce on this, that any foreign investments can't have control in the company. And there's control comes by, you know, a certain amount of majority ownership and or, you know, board positions and things like that. So we have to fence off foreign money that we have. And we have a combination of, you know, U.S. and I would say primarily European investors in Phantom. A lot of it is family offices. So we have one VC that was in one of our early rounds, but largely we've avoided the VC financing. We're a little too early for private equity and things like that. But you know, we're finding enough appetite in the family office community and small VCs that I think we'll stick there. I had a particularly bad experience with VCs on my last company, so I'm cautious. Sure. About that, that, you know, the VCs have a formula. They're very successful. They have a formula on how they do it, and I think it's tough in the space business to mesh the VC formula with sort of the long term and high capital needs of space industry. So yeah. we're all veterans, us co-founders of other companies, yeah. and have raised lots of money. So we're bringing those lessons to this. And trying to make Phantom something that we're going to be with for a long, long time,
yeah.
and make successful, because we're mission oriented, yeah. more than we are money oriented on this. But part of that mission orientation comes from retaining a fairly strong control of the company, yeah. and that's been a big part of our strategy on how we go forward with this company.
Can you talk about launch site expansion? I think you mentioned that Phantom Space works with, do you have four different launch sites, not including the potential for landlocked sites that would accommodate horizontal launches?
Correct. So yeah. So we have two sites that we have signed paperwork with. Vandenberg, we have leased Space Launch Complex 5, mm-hmm. which is an old NASA scout pad. So we'll be operating from there. We're undergoing environmental assessments right now, just to because we're using different fuels and so forth. We've got to update all of that. Should be pretty straightforward, but it's going to take some time and some capital to operate out of Vandenberg. We have a site up at Alaska we've signed on recently, and Alaska can also accommodate polar launches. We're working with Space Florida and the 45th Space Wing, the U.S., well, I guess it's no longer Air Force, U.S. DOD, to have a permanent launch site out there. That's going to take a little bit longer, but we'll probably operate out of SLC 40 or Space Complex 46, which is the Space Florida commercial pad for our first launches. Mm-hmm. And then eventually our permanent home out there. We're also talking to Camden. They're getting very close to being licensed. They're just up the road from Cape Canaveral on the East Coast. And then Virginia is the other one that we haven't yet to talk to with any seriousness that will probably end up there. Now long-term, you know, we see places like Yuma, who wants to put a spaceport in, Midland, who has a spaceport, and there's one in Michigan and so forth, and some foreign spaceports that we've already begun discussing, like the Sweden. We're long down the road on that one, mm-hmm. But we know it's a long road to go. So, you know, we're foreseeing, you know, launch out of Europe within about 5 years. Yeah. So, you know, we're taking a worldwide view of this. We're talking to Brazilians about equatorial launch there. We've got some other sort of interesting small countries in the equatorial area. They have islands that have been inviting us to consider having launches there. There's a little more political complexity with taking these weapon systems, as the Defense Department sees them, into
sure.
foreign countries outside of U.S. control and launching them from there. But it's workable. You just have to you know, work through it and have the patience.
So you mentioned being surprised at the ultimate success of SpaceX, which I think many people were, and being surprised at the retirement of the space shuttle program, which obviously came as a shock to many people. What's your best guess of the state of the space economy 5 years from now?
Yeah, so I've been sort of like the cheerleader on the market side. One of the things I did at Strategic Space was market assessments since the days I left SpaceX. And so I was, of all the, you know, prognosticators, one of the more optimistic. So I can tell you that even my predictions for where things are at did not match the reality. This explosion of growth in the number of small satellites and the amount of capital that's flowing into it continues to surprise me. Which says to me, I think that all the estimates for this market are really way, way under what the reality is going to turn out to be. Mm-hmm. I'm becoming increasingly bullish on it. You know, even since we started Phantom, you know, the amount of capital interest we're shocked by. We're really, frankly, shocked by it. I won't say it's easy to raise money, but it's a whole lot easier to raise money than it was 5 years ago for this stuff. Mm-hmm. And you would think it would go the opposite direction. You'd think that investors would place the bets on the winning horses and leave the sector, but that's not happening. And I think it's fueled in large measure by SpaceX. And, you know, people are starting to see, you know, I think their latest number was $60 to $90 billion valuation. And you start seeing numbers like that, that really attracts a lot of attention.
Sure.
And even, you know, in our peers, you know, there's SPACs being announced at $1-4 billion. So that's driving a lot of investor interest here. And, you know, there's reason, I think, beyond just pure speculation, why, you know, those kinds of valuations are being attached to these business models, because they can churn out a lot of cash. And it's in a frontier economy that's growing. And it's an economy that I think is, despite everybody's predictions, has exceeded everybody's performance predictions. So to me, I'm sad that it's come when I'm in my 50s. I wish it would have happened when I was in my early 30s and had longer to exploit it. But
youth is wasted on the young. Youth is wasted on the young. So with that in mind, what's the biggest opportunity in space? I mean, obviously, investors are throwing a lot of money at space generally, but is there one area that is, you think, maybe deserves a second look?
Yeah, and this is the focus of Phantom Cloud. If you look at the way satellites communicate with the Earth, it's kind of like how we communicated with each other over bulletin board systems. If you're old enough to remember, you know, I'd have to get on my modem, which was, I had a 12K modem. I remember thinking that was just really badass, you know, when I was in college. And I would dial somebody else's computer up over the phone line with my 12K modem. And I would download, you know, all the files I was interested in, the chat, whatever it was, put my own stuff up and then go along. And that's how satellites still communicate. So here we are living in this world with instant everything. You and I are on Zoom right now, and you're in a basement somewhere on the East Coast, and I'm, you know, in the desert here and on the West Coast, and we're having this great conversation, yet our satellites are acting like it's the 1980s all over again. So I can even hear Madonna playing when the satellites are downlinking the data. And so I think that's really where one of the huge opportunities is moving bits around the world, worldwide through space, and servicing our satellites and making that part of space really the next great internet, and having the bits as mobile as the physical asset is itself. So that beyond that, the other part of it is what I call photons to decision. So if you look at really Earth observation, all it is a information system. These satellites, they're like computers. You're gathering photons back from the Earth, and you ultimately turn that into decision quality data, whether it's an investment, i.e. you're watching the oil tanks in China and everywhere else to see how much oil people really stockpile, and turn that into an investment decision, to roofing companies that are looking at, gee, what's the condition of the neighborhood roofs, and what are my opportunities to go out and pitch these guys on a new roof? You know, it becomes photons to decisions. And I think that people have looked at this sector much in the same way that the government has, which is, oh, well, we're voyeurs, and we're looking down on everybody. We're just going to see what we can see, right? I think that the innovation and the really smart people have yet to apply themselves to this. Not saying that the people in the business aren't smart, but I'm talking about the really creative people that come up with things like Uber, Lyft, and, you know, I don't know, RV share.
Yeah.
All these things that you could do with your phone that I would have never imagined. Right? Yeah. I'm just astonished at the amount of innovation that's come into the mobile telecommunications sector and the apps that you can get on your phone. That's what we need for photons to decisions.
Yeah, it's like a geospatial platform. Like a
right.
Yeah. Let's start.
That's what we want to. That's what we want to trigger. Mm-hmm. We want to trigger enough infrastructure so that this becomes possible. But we can't do it until there's an easy way to get your stuff up there, an easy way to move it around, an easy way to get your data back. And that's what Phantom's about, is really setting the stage for that next wave of innovation.
That's and on that note, I say, here, Phantom Space. Jim Cantrell, space visionary, setting the space infrastructure in motion for the next great economic revolution, shall we say. Thank you so much for speaking with Investable Universe this week.
My pleasure.
It was great. Good luck on that round.
Hey, thank you. We'll get it closed. We're about halfway there.
Yeah, we'll keep us posted.
I will. Awesome. Thanks for interviewing me.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's all we got for Investable Universe this week. If you liked what you heard, share the link, check out the site at investableuniverse.com, or pitch us for future episodes. The address is editor@investableuniverse.com. My name is Rebecca Darst, and you'll hear more from me next time.